Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jason.
We're on the precipice of WWDC.
Just sort of balancing over the abyss.
Yep.
Teetering, if you will.
Yep. Somebody could come up behind us and push us right off.
I think that's what Sunday is called.
That's Sunday night. Yeah. The Sandman on Sunday night comes and says, keto time. Oh, what is it like to have a keynote in the afternoon?
It's nice. I usually eat lunch and then basically, because I eat lunch at noon and then like at one, there we go. It's ready to go. So
you know
what? I just sit on the couch and watch it. I heard you saying you were going to sit on the couch and watch it. I was like, yeah. You and Mike. And I was like, I've been doing that for years. That's been like my MO was like, I sit on the couch in the living room and I have my laptop in front of me and I watch and I type some stuff.
I don't know. I don't know why I did last year. I did it like at my desk, but I had that moment of like, well, I should do this more like on the couch where the TV is big, because all I'm doing is watching a screen. I should have it be the big screen in the house.
Yeah, it's nice. You want that big screen experience. You hook it up to your, you know, surround sound, and maybe there'll be spatial audio this time. Who knows? You know, it could be, there could be all sorts of audio effects.
Well, I am looking forward to doing that, and maybe I'll try to make it special. That's an idea that just popped in my head. Maybe I'll go get some like bagels or donuts or something like a treat. Have a little morning treat, little brunchy treat. Because,
well, that's the thing. Like when I used to travel for keynotes, like I would go with you. Oftentimes, we'd get our little free pastries at the little, you know, whatever little services they had set up there. And then you go in and you watch. But it was like early in the morning, right? It was like 9 or 10 in the morning, right? So you'd be in there and...
Yeah, the show's at 10, right? But they'd tell you to be there at 9.
Early. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you have time then to eat and drink tea if you want, or, you know, use the facilities, that all that jazz.
Sure. And if you're going to drink some tea, you definitely need to
use the facilities. Yeah. And you schmooze a little bit, talk to some folks.
Yeah.
I do miss that aspect of it. It's always nice to see people, and you know, people especially that you only see at these events.
Yeah, it's a little reunion kind of thing. Yeah. That's where I would always see Heather Kelly.
Yep.
Who used to work at Macworld and was working at CNN. She's now at the Washington Post. Speaking of the Washington Post, this wasn't planned, but I'm going to be... So the Apple apparently said yesterday that they're going to adjust some things with AirTags, and they're going to have the sort of stalking warning happen faster, and they committed to doing like an Android app because they have heard the criticism that even though they took a lot of steps to prevent these from being sort of misused, that there are people like envisioned all sorts of different holes to that, which there's a lot of coverage of this, and... I think this is a good move because I think Apple has actually been trying to be doing the right thing with this product all along, and that may actually be one of the reasons that this product was delayed as long as it was. But I think that the criticism was valid. However, I did have to roll my eyes at journalists who wrote stories about it, patting themselves on the back for having caused this to happen, which I think in aggregate is probably true, but that is a fundamental danger if you're a writer to say, it was me, I did it. And I think Jeffrey Fowler from the Washington Post did that on Twitter yesterday, and I'm like, come on, dude, you're not the only person who wrote about this issue. But he's like, I guess Apple agrees with me. Yes, it's all about you. When this actually came up because I posted the enterprise report card thing this week. I had several people say, I hope Apple listens. And then I had several people say, come on, Apple doesn't listen. And I had to tell my story, which I know you've heard, but I'll just try to repeat it here really briefly, which is, can a single story change Apple's collective mind? I guess, yes. But I think more likely what happens if you're somebody who writes about this stuff or talks about this stuff is it gets like, you know, Phil Schiller sent around the report card to people at Apple. Like, okay, great. It can be part of the conversation. But that's sort of the point, is that when we write things criticizing Apple or saying Apple should do this or Apple should do that, it's not like there's a collective Apple that looks at that and goes, oh boy, that Jason, he had a great idea. Let's do that. I had never thought of that before. Instead, what you have is all the people who are making decisions at Apple, and they use the sentiment of the, whether it's the customers or people who have opinions about this stuff, as evidence in their arguments about why Apple should do such a thing. So it's more like, not I hope Apple listens, it's more like I hope the people at Apple who are arguing for the thing that we want are able to use this thing.
Right, the ammunition.
As a battering ram for, like, see, I told you, we do need to do better at this. That's sort of how, in my mind, that's the right way to approach it, and not sort of like, oh, I'm going to change minds with this one. I hope Apple's listening. I'm going to send an email to Phil Schiller with a link to it because he really needs to see this. Like, no, that's not. No. And they do read what is written about them, believe it or not, they do. But it's a more complex situation than just I wrote a thing and Apple changed its policy. Generally.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there's a zeitgeist aspect to it. There's also, I feel like, in some ways, an SEO almost aspect to it, where it's like, you know, someone inside Apple searching for, like, I wonder if people want this thing or something. And then they Google it and they find, like, you know, people have written about, oh, hey, people are complaining about this thing. Maybe I can use that as an argument for why we should devote more resources to this or why we should consider this. And
exactly.
Yeah, it is. I agree. It's part of the conversation. It provides examples and evidence and arguments, like fodder, basically. But it's not. I think rare is the occasion when one person's like, this is bad, they should fix it. I mean, you know, that's like how security works, right? Like, sure, if you're a security researcher and you're like, I found a bug, it does this. You're like, oh, crap, we better fix that.
And I have no doubt that the AirTag stuff was a reaction to bad press where people were pointing out flaws. I have no doubt about it. So, you know, when I complain about Jeffrey Fowler, for example, I'm really just saying it seemed a little self-congratulatory and like, don't sprain yourself too much by patting yourself on the back. Yeah. Like, yeah, I mean, and I mean, there were worse takes. I also saw the person from the EFF who was basically like, well, I won't be satisfied until they ship their Android app. And it's like, well, boy, well, the world is waiting for you to be personally satisfied by Apple's deeds. But people, what you going to do? Anyway, I do think, though, that Apple is very aware of criticism. And I think in a case like this, where it's criticism about a product where they were already trying to preempt the criticism, I'm sure it hit home. And I'm sure there were probably people inside who it's also possible they were already working on this stuff, but they thought they could ship it and then kind of like upgrade it a little bit later. But, you know, it or somebody want to bet, right? Somebody won the argument where it's like, yeah, see, I told you we should do an Android app. And they're like, all right, yeah, do the Android app. Okay.
Right. And I mean, to me, you know, we knew already, they said in several of their interviews, like this could be adjusted, right? Like this stuff could be adjusted remotely. In this case, they're pushing, I guess, firmware updates basically to AirTags.
Yeah.
And we knew that was the case.
Yeah, they said that up front.
I think it was right, and I think it was clear. I think that was a signal, right? A signal that like, look, we have done a lot to try and mitigate this as much as possible. No system is perfect, and we might have gotten some stuff wrong. So we sort of reserve the right to basically be able to make adjustments in the future based on more data and more stuff that we learned and things that we may not have thought of. And I think that made a lot of sense. And it also shows that they do, I think it's hard to argue they don't have like a dedication to this, right? Like, I mean, Apple does not make an Android app lightly. They've done it a few times, but they're not going to invest the resources in doing that unless they feel very strongly about something, right? I mean, you know, the Apple Music has an Android app. There have been one or two others, I want to say, but not a lot. And so the fact that they're like, you know what, we've realized this needs an Android app, to me says we're going to put our money where our mouth is, essentially, because that means spending time and resources developing an app that is not for their platform, which is, again, not something that they can just whip up as easily, right? They have to have people who are, you know, capable of designing and implementing stuff for a different platform. So I think to me that says, yeah, we are committed to getting this right, and we realize we may not get it right on the first try, but we're going to keep investing in it.
There's also, I will say, a lot of people, and I'm not, Apple's a giant company, right? There was actually a really good post that I saw from somebody who's like, Apple's a giant company. Like, a lot of Apple's sins are every giant company sins because the problem is giant companies, not Apple. But sure. So I'm not trying to say, oh, we shouldn't criticize Apple. But I'm trying to say that there are people out there who are looking for every possible misstep from Apple. And also then to fit it into a narrative about all the bad things Apple does. And I look at something like AirTags and the fact that they made this commitment and that they had, they were aware that they might need to adjust the system behind it and that they built this whole system with privacy in mind. And the first reaction that somebody has to the product is, well, I found a couple of edge cases that are really bad. So Apple is obviously terrible and they've done a terrible thing. It's like, okay, I mean, that's a take you can have. And they don't deserve to be let off the hook. But at the same time, like, could you give them a little credit and maybe a little bit of the benefit of the doubt that they really are committed to these not being stalker friendly devices, and that anything that you found is probably something that had they felt like they could do it or they anticipated it, that they would have done it? And then you see them follow up here and it's like, yes, they're following up to criticism, but also you could say they're following up to people pointing out holes in their thing and they're committed to fixing them, right? Like, it's just, I know that this is a little bit squishy, but it's really like, basically, if you want to take them to the woodshed, you can do it. You can find a weakness, but I find it weird that it's in an area where Apple seems to actually want to do the right thing. Like, of all the things to poke at Apple for, this is a weird one. Like, pointing out the flaws, I think, is good, but like, this is clearly a product that was designed trying to avoid these issues. And yet, some of those stories are so frantic about, like, oh, Apple, they did this terrible thing. And I was like, well, no, they probably, you know, they obviously missed some stuff, but they seem pretty committed to making this right. Otherwise, they wouldn't have done any of this stuff with the product. Part of the problem, too, is Apple's PR, right? Because Apple still, as much as Apple's PR has changed, they still are black boxy in a lot of ways, where they're like, we got our company line and we're not going to respond. And it doesn't really serve them in crisis, right? We've seen this several times when there's been a story emerging about some flaw in a product and they stonewall and they don't answer questions, or they in misleading ways kind of misdirect to the answer. And then eventually they'll come out with the most reluctant statement. And that's, you know, it's one of those things where a different company's PR being a little more open might actually serve them better in this case, where they're like, you know, we've heard the criticism and we're gonna take it and we're gonna go look at this, and because we are committed to this as a thing. And instead, oftentimes the answer is they're criticized, there's silence, and then a month later Apple's like, oh, we did this thing now.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so it's definitely one of those things where I think it's hard to deal with as a big company. You don't turn on a dime, right? And it is something that definitely comes up a lot of times with, you know, problems that might occur. Stuff falls through the cracks. That's just the way it goes. And you know, there's a range of takes, right? Like the one end of the range is like Apple is perfect and can do no wrong. And the other end of the take is like, they designed these things so you could track people, right? And neither of those are true, as it turns out. The truth is somewhere in between. And yeah, so I don't know. I think they did the best they felt they could do in the time frame they had and committed to doing better in the future. And I think it's hard to ask for a lot more than that. Beyond that, you're just saying maybe you shouldn't have released this product. And I don't think, as so far as we can tell, the disadvantages have outweighed the potential advantages.
Also, those other products exist. A good criticism of this that I think is, I think was interesting, is the problem with Apple doing it is Apple's much better at this and they have more devices, so they're going to be able to detect more of this stuff. So it's really like Tile isn't going to be a problem because it's not that good. And that's not a slight on Tile. It's like Tile's network isn't that good because Tile isn't a platform owner, but Apple is. And that does mean that Apple has greater responsibility because it's going to be able to, its devices will be much more trackable. I totally get that.
And you get the sort of the counterpart to this is the reputation is part of this, right? Apple's made a big deal about privacy being central to it and about it taking it seriously. So when you set yourself up as a poster child of something like that, you're going to get harsher criticism, right? Because people hold you to a higher standard. Contrast it with Amazon Sidewalk, which has also been in the news a bunch this week, right? Which is this system that Amazon has designed to essentially turn all of its devices into a mesh network where it even shares the Wi-Fi, sort of. It has like a back channel Wi-Fi thing that it can serve. Now, Amazon, you know, and I think John Gruber wrote about this a little bit in Daring Fireball last night or this morning, and his point was, you know, if you're already comfortable with the privacy trade-offs you've made on your Echo or your Ring or doorbell or whatever, then, yeah, there's no reason you shouldn't be worried about this. You've already kind of opened the door to that, which is a bit glib, but is also not entirely untrue. I think Amazon handled that slightly less well because they made it an opt-in thing that most people will not find, right? They turned it on.
Exactly.
And we're like, this is a great benefit to all of our users. There's no way it could possibly go wrong, and we're going to automatically opt everybody in. It's like, well, that is the hubris take, right? At least, if nothing else, you know, Apple, I think, made it clear, like, the AirTags are a thing that you opt into, or Find My iPhone is a thing that you turn on, or Find My Friends is a thing that you specifically activate, you know, and that's your choice. Even if your device might potentially get used. I don't know if that's true. Does your device get used to locate things if your Find My is not on? I have no idea.
Yes,
probably.
If your Find My is not on, maybe not. But
yeah.
It's because it needs to know where you are.
Right. Yeah. Good point. Right. So I think there are good and bad ways to handle that, and a lot of it also is going to depend on your image and your what you have stated as a priority. And it's not to say Amazon is totally anti-privacy, but they have made many decisions in the past that show that perhaps it's not a thing they always think about at the forefront, right? Like, it's sometimes something that they think about after the fact and are like, oh yeah, we should care about that. And they're at odds because they're a company that deals with building personal information profiles, right? Like, that's kind of part of their bread and butter. And so it's going to kind of be against their interests if they're like, oh, we don't want to collect any information.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it ultimately was Amazon Sidewalk is an interesting idea that I kind of like, and I don't like the fact that they opted everybody in, right?
Right.
Like,
sure.
I think, and I get why you opt everybody in. I get it. It's easier to not ask. But, like, that is a great example.
And it's more effective, too, right? Yeah. Like, it's if they have to go and convince everybody to turn it on, it will never reach its peak efficiency of what it's
maybe
intended
you
to do.
You play the long game and you have it prompt you on setup for new devices.
Sure. Yeah.
And the next time you open your settings app for any of Amazon's apps, it could ask you, introducing Amazon Sidewalk, this is great. And then, you know, I would actually even be okay if in that scenario you had to choose to opt out, right? Like, the okay was, I'm going to join Amazon Sidewalk, and then there was a, I don't want to join. But, like, you got to put it in somebody's face. I think that that's their mistake, and it really doesn't matter who you are. And I have some level of trust with Amazon, believe it or not. I have Amazon devices in my house. I think Gruber is sort of right that, like, there is a level of trust already there. But, like, the fact that they didn't ask and that they don't really explain well what they're doing, I just went and turned it off because I'm like, what?
Yep, same.
And the truth is, it's actually kind of a clever idea because it's the doing ads on podcasts. I've done those Eero ads, right, where you're like, they ask for a testimonial, and I have Eeros in my house, and they'll say, like, oh, Jason, what do you think of this? Mike will say, and I'll say, well, I've got the Wi-Fi sprinkler controller that's in the back of my house in a weird location. I've got a Wi-Fi camera in a weird corner location, and I spread my Wi-Fi, and then those devices are seen. Well, Amazon Sidewalk is basically like, yeah, but what if your back fence neighbor's Wi-Fi extends to where you're putting this thing? That's enough, right? Like, good enough. And it's like, yeah, that's actually kind of brilliant that the device vendor, I actually think this is a future direction maybe for something like Matter, right? The new Home Alliance. Sure. Is like, if you come up with a standard where devices can get on a known set of Wi-Fi networks in an encrypted way where they're separated and they're rate limited, which is what Amazon Sidewalk is, it's kind of great because it's like mesh networking, and you probably have enough bandwidth to help your neighbors out. And the truth is you help your neighbors and they help you. And now your neighborhood, your devices are going to be more functional. Like, it's kind of a great idea, but boy, did they mess it up in the way they rolled it out.
Selling it was that was not the right way to sell it necessarily, but we'll see. I mean, I think you're right that the IoT stuff, and this is something I'm actually very hopeful that we will hear more about next week from Apple, given that it has, you know, bought into this consortium and it seems to be making moves towards making smart home, improving its smart home tech setup. I'd love to hear more about that because it's something I've become increasingly invested in, especially as I, you know, get closer and closer to being an actual, I'm a home owner, but a home liver. I don't know what to call that. A home dweller.
A home liver is interesting. It's like it's,
that sounds like, bad when I think about it. How about dweller? How about a home dweller?
Are you near the home kidneys? Is that
home gallbladder?
I mean, if you say so.
So, anyways, yeah, it's on my list for things that I'm hopeful that Apple will talk about a bit next week.
Yeah, that was a weird on the upgrade draft. That was a little bit of a reach that is looking a little bit better now, which is. And listeners to the Six Colors podcast will know that I have my home tech conspiracy. You and I both are conspirators in the Apple's doing something, but what is it? Mm-hmm. And yes, I'm still really hopeful that WWDC is going to have a home segment, basically, where they talk about Apple's sort of home strategy a little bit more. Yep. And the rumor, well, it's not even a rumor, the report that there was an Apple job that was posted that referred to Home OS that now refers to tvOS and HomePod or something.
HomePod, yeah.
It's like, well, yeah, rebranding that as HomeOS actually kind of makes sense, right? Because it's all of the devices in your home, including your Apple TV and your HomePod and whatever else comes next. And it's like, okay, and you throw in the Thread radios and you throw in the Matter Alliance and like something's going on there. I could see, so maybe we'll get something like that. But yeah, Amazon Sidewalk, come on. You know, it's just it's not always better to ask forgiveness than seek permission.
Right. Right. Especially in technology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Let's see what else. I mean, I realize that a lot of Six Colors readers are not necessarily super tied into the Apple and the enterprise area, the Mac IT kind of admin area. But that was a fun project. To replay the report card thing, but ask a bunch of IT managers about it. I definitely got some feedback after I posted it from people who are like, these are the guys who always want to tell you what to do and the users want to control their systems. And it's like, well, yes, but no, I felt like this group got it more than I actually expected in terms of praising Apple's security and privacy commitment, even if it means that their jobs are harder. A lot of them really said that, which I think is really good. And will come to no surprise to anybody that Apple's hardware scores were really good and their software scores were really bad. So yeah, there you go.
Yep.
Anyway, it's there with many verbatims, but the top line is kind of fun. And yes, unsurprisingly, hardware and security and privacy scored really well. And deployment did really badly. So if you're a Mac admin, you're like, oh man, deployment, then you know what I'm talking about. And if you don't, count yourself lucky, really. If you look at that score, count yourself lucky.
Well, it's a microcosm. I mean, not microcosm, but it's a reflection of the same critiques I feel like we've had on the consumer side, at least certainly in the iPad realm, maybe a little bit in the Mac realm, but less so than maybe a couple of years ago, which is that hardware continues to be pretty solid and software continues to feel like, yeah, it could be better.
Mm-hmm. So our Macworld columns this week were sort of wish lists of features on the iPad and the Mac for the developer conference next week. Mm-hmm. We should at least, I guess, mention those.
Yeah.
People can read them at Macworld. My wish list, you know, it's stuff that you've probably heard from me before. Right. I still have hardware on my list. There was another report today that said that hardware is not coming, that there's not going to be new laptops or new chips. I'm most fascinated by the idea of what does the second Apple Silicon chip for Mac look like? What is that?
Yeah.
And there are all those rumors about it, but like until we see it, because that will start to give us an idea. You can't connect the dots until there are two dots, right?
Yes. Connecting one dot to itself is not as informative.
You
could
do that.
Think.
You leave the dot and you draw something, and then it's like basically an etch-a-sketch.
Step three, another dot.
Yeah. So I'm that. Even more than the individual, like a MacBook Pro and maybe two MacBook Pros and maybe a Mac Mini, like even more than that stuff. And, you know, developers love that. Like if this was an in-person conference, like when they've announced Pro laptops or other Pro hardware, they eat that up, right? Because developers are, I think Apple has even said at some point, like perhaps Apple's most, if not important, pretty close to most important and most plentiful Pro user is the app developer, right? And they love laptops, Pro laptops. They love Pro hardware in general. if they've got pro laptops ready to show, I'm sure they would love to show them. With all of the component shortages that are going on, it is entirely possible that they wanted to show them, but they can't commit to it. And even though they're not selling a lot of Intel MacBook Pros right now, because those people know, those buyers generally, they know that there's something else coming, right? But how long do you want to make them wait, right? Like, you don't really, I think Apple has an optimal amount of time where it's like, you tell them, then you've got a couple of weeks until they can order them, and then a couple of weeks after that, they can get them.
Right.
And they don't want to do it where, like, you tell them, but then you got to wake them up in 6 weeks when they can order them. Like, that's not as effective. I really think that Apple knows that to be the case. So if they push too far out, you can't do that. So that to me is the question. But I'm sure they would like to, and as Stephen Hackett wrote in his column yesterday, half the time in the last decade, 60% of the time in the last 20 years, Apple has done a hardware announcement at the developer conference. So it does happen, and generally it's sort of hardware-themed if they can do it, other than that period where it was all iPhones. But even then, it was all developer-themed, right? Because it was all like, here are the new features, and you guys need to write apps. So I don't know. I think it's possible, but all my other wish list things are like shortcuts on the Mac and you know, other stuff, bulking up Catalyst and Swift UI and bringing stuff over a lot of stuff over from iPad and iPhone to Mac, just to keep sort of compatibility across them and have a better app story now that Apple Silicon is rolling out, like make the experience of running apps on iOS apps on Mac better so that you can maybe convince people to opt their apps back into the platform, stuff like that. And then my last item for the Mac was simply, despite all of my wish list items, keep it cool. Don't do too much. A year of stability would be good right about now, given everything that's going on with Apple Silicon and all of that. Maybe keep it cool otherwise.
Yeah. I mean, in my iPad list was very similar to stuff that you and I have discussed both on this podcast and elsewhere. You know, coming up with a new multitasking system that feels like it fits a little better on what's happening, because that is a thing that is increasingly feel like a real shortcoming of iPadOS, especially now that we have iPad Pros that run on the same silicon as Macs. Bringing the Pro apps over, obviously, which we've also talked about a bunch, whether it's, you know, Logic or Final Cut Pro or Xcode, it feels more and more embarrassing for Apple not to have its own first-party stuff available on its own platform. That just... I can't see how that can last that much longer at this point.
Yep. And in the upgrade draft, I actually put that down as I think this is it. I think the M1 iPad Pro means they have to do something. And they have to do something in order to sort of like say, see, this is what we were doing here. Like, this is the perfect time for them to finally say, oh yeah, we did Final Cut for the iPad. And then maybe that's it. Maybe they don't handle external displays this year, and maybe they don't rethink multitasking and windowing. I hope they do. But if they don't, but they throw out something like Final Cut and say, well, this you can use on the external display because it's doing the output to the external display, and haha, we cheated there. Like, that would probably get them by. Like, but I have a hard time having them go through the whole thing and basically
do minor updates
to the iPad and say, and also the M1 iPads go up to 16 gigs of RAM and there's no reason for it. And in fact, apps are still limited to a certain amount. That's the part that really got me. Yeah. Somebody reported that apps are actually limited to, 4 gigs of RAM or something. It's like, no, you can't. So something's got to give.
It feels like it's been put off a lot. And, I was surprised to, go back and look at the sort of history of some of the multitasking stuff. And it goes back to iOS 9, right? And, we're talking about 6 years now, essentially, since it first added any multitasking capability. And it refined it a little bit since then.
One time, basically.
One time, yeah.
And otherwise it's broken.
Fairly untouched. And that's a long time. Like, if you got to hope that even at that first part, they were not like in 2015, we solved it, right? Like, job done, walk away. I would assume that they were continuing to work and iterate on it and try to find something. So I'm not saying like, you've had a year to figure this out. It's no, you've had 6 years to figure this out.
Yeah.
And to come up with something or, that is a little bit better. And so I think that's, They got to do it. Maybe it doesn't happen this year. I think that will be very disappointing to many people, but it's certainly possible.
Yeah, I'm encouraged. about it, mostly because it just seems so logical. And maybe this isn't the year, but the M1 iPad Pro, I feel like that's the thing that makes me believe more. And as I've mm-hmm. gone on about elsewhere, and I'll just say again, windowing, right? Like, I feel like having a windowing mode and having the ability to sort of like pull iPadOS away from iOS and have it be like, you can still do like on the Mac split view or full screen, but like, or you cannot do that. And yeah. that gets things to be much more interesting. Right. On the Pro App side, I do wonder sometimes if the reason we haven't seen them is that they didn't feel like they could do a good enough experience with the hardware that they had. Like, it's not just we need this to justify the hardware, but it's literally, oh, now that we have devices with 8 gigs or 16 gigs of RAM, or even if you include the last iPad Pro, 6 gigs of RAM, now we could say we'll do Final Cut. And it'll only run on those systems. Like, it could have been right. that they tried it, right. they investigated earlier, and they're like, no, it's not enough for this
right. and, to happen. As we've discussed before, this is, pick your metaphor depending on whether you want to be optimistic and say they made this bed for themselves, or pessimistic and say they dug this grave for themselves. But naming it the M1 yeah. is a thing they did. That was a choice. Choosing to use yep. the same exact chip, they did that with full knowledge of what that would mean. That is a decision that they made that they now have to live with.
Right. They were going to use that chip regardless, but they could have yeah. said it was the A14X.
Yep, and nobody would have blinked, and nobody would have been like, all right, fine.
But there would have been a story that's like, the A14X is really the M1, right? But it would have been Apple's like, no, it's not.
Sure.
It's an A14X. It's different. And you know, that would have been a kind of wink, wink, nudge, nudge thing. But they're like, no, M1.
Yep. And I mean, it's great branding. They leaned yeah. hard into it. And now they're going to, have to sort of deal with the consequences of
it.
That.
Which also potentially means that they knew, right? Like, we are speculating about it, but like, they made that M1 decision knowing what was coming.
Yes.
Next.
100%.
So that's the other way to read that, is like, they're not like scrambling to justify the M1 decision.
It's a breadcrumb. Yeah.
They made the M1 decision knowing what they're going to announce this summer. Of course, if on Monday they announce kind of bupkis for the iPad, then we're going to be like, you made that decision knowing that? Right?
Why would you do that?
But they obviously thought that
and then not something you can... Not something you can blame on, like, the software thing is fun too, right? Because hardware, as we've discussed, and we discussed this earlier with the supply chain issues, right? Like, there's always challenges. There are external challenges to Apple doing what it might want to do in terms of when things are available and how many things are available. Software is a little different. Software is on them, right? Like, that is the challenges are internal mostly at that point, right? And once your hardware is established, which it now has been, everything kind of is down to, how did you manage this software workflow, right? Like, how did you deal with your pipeline, your internal pipeline for when you are developing things and rolling them out? But there's not, you know, you can say the pandemic, for example, is a challenge that's external to your software workflow. I think in most cases, software is probably not something that is as affected by, say, remote work as hardware design, for example, might have been. But I think, you know, yeah, there is very little for them to blame if they can't deliver on a better software experience other than themselves.
Yep. Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to getting the resolution of all of this. And it may seem like we really enjoy speculating about what is to come, but you know what I really like is talking about what is.
Yes. Knowing things is much better than thinking about what could happen.
Yeah. I mean, that gets you through the cold winter months, but it's good to actually have... Because the great thing about, this is a good way to end this one, I think, is the great thing about WWDC is that it is, I always call it the start of Apple's product year, essentially. This is where it says, here's where our operating systems and our platforms are going for the next year. It really is like New Year's Day for Apple. It is, I know it's confusing because they already have their financial quarters are the wrong calendar, but like just metaphorically, it's the start of something. We are wrapping up Big Sur year and all the other OS versions, and we're going to see what the next, and it doesn't start right away for most people. It's a process. There are betas, then there's the finals, but like, this is kind of the basis for everything we're going to see and talk about and use for the next year. And so that's what I find really exciting about it, is that you dig into the details, and you not only are there lots of details about like what's in the keynote, what's in the State of the Union stuff, and then what's in all those individual sessions, and obviously we're gonna write our stuff about it next week, and there's great stuff to be dug up in there. But it's not just the facts that are laid down. It's also what it says about what Apple's priorities are. And that's really great, because that informs what they do for the next year and what we see and how we analyze it. And that all comes out. This is their biggest declaration. You know, I look for crumbs when they're doing the analyst call, right? It's like, ooh, they said this one thing in an interesting way. But like WWDC is the brain dump of like everything Apple is thinking of in terms of their platforms, because they need to get the developers on board.
Well, it's the loaf. It's the loaf that you found the crumbs off of.
Oh yeah, you're right. That's right. We spend quarters and quarters just looking for those little crumbs, and then they bake us a nice loaf of bread on a Monday in June. also my son's last week of school for the school year, because that always happens. So it's feeling really like traditional WWDC. All I need is like a dance recital to go to, and then we would be set for traditional.
Or you know, having people descend upon the Bay Area.
Yeah, I could just drive down to San Jose on Sunday night and ask where everybody is and then drive
camp
home.
Out in front of the convention center.
Yeah, yeah. I thought about that. I thought about, could I just sit in front of the McHenry Convention Center and do my report about what's going on? Where is everybody?
Just on the other side of these walls.
Yes, is nothing.
Nothing's happened. We could go record a podcast standing in a park by ourselves.
We could.
No listeners.
Nope. All right. Well, we will be back next week, and boy, will there be a lot. But until then, bye, Dan.
Bye, Jason.